We hope and trust that you will find this Torah in Motion program meaningful. Through these programs, Torah in Motion encourages discussion, debate, and education about the most important issues facing Jews and Judaism today. Together, we can focus on creating religious commitment through an honest and sophisticated encounter with topics that are relevant to being Jewish in the modern world. For more information about this and other Torah in Motion programs, please visit the website at www.torahinmotion.org.
A couple minutes, so please, if you can find and welcome to what we hope and are sure will be informative and hopefully inspiring people, an opportunity to ask a lot of questions and to hear some of the experts really in the field of business ethics in general, not only in Jewish business ethics. Really, our presenters this evening are academics and industrialists. They're really working very much in the secular world, not just only in the from a Jewish approach. Just the Torah in Vayikra tells us on the prohibition of interest. And right after the prohibition of interest, or in the context, the Torah tells us that Ani Hashem Elokecha Asher Hotzeiticha Etchem Me'eretz Mitzrayim. That's a familiar concept. I am the Lord your God who took you out of the land of Egypt. And of course, so the question is, what is the connection between Egypt and the prohibition of interest? And Rashi basically says that God took us out of Egypt for the purpose of keeping the mitzvot that are monetary mitzvot of Judaism is why God took us out of Egypt. And that's what makes us into a special nation. And Rashi points out, even though it's hard, that the mitzvot of money are hard mitzvot. We all have a tremendous inclination to make money in any way that we can. And Rashi also points out, we have a tendency to rationalize all kinds of activities that aren't so kosher. We have a tendency, we rationalize them. The Torah wants to tell us by the mitzvah, which is a very interesting mitzvah in its own right, the prohibition of interest on this important concept of Egypt. I just want to say that as a word of introduction, these are not easy concepts all the time, but they are the basis of what makes us into a holy nation. We'll start right away. I want to introduce our first speaker, who I've had the pleasure of hearing already five or six times at least over Shabbos and on Thursday and Friday morning, Rabbi Dr. Asher Meyer, who's a native of Maplewood in New Jersey. He's a graduate of Harvard and MIT with a PhD in economics. He worked for a year at the Council of Economic Advisors in the Reagan administration, made Aliyah in 1986, where he learned in the Kollel in Gush Etzion for many, many years. And he recently became the head of the research on the Center of Business Ethics, the head of its department on research, and he is the author of the column of the Jewish Ethicist, which I'm sure many of you have seen on the internet. He's a resident of Efrat, and I want to thank his wife, who is home with their triplets and three other children. So I want to thank her for letting him come and spend a few days with us. And without further ado, I want to introduce Rabbi Dr. Asher Meyer.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank Rabbi Kelman for bringing me here to Toronto. I've had a very interesting time in the many different speaking arrangements that I've already had, as he pointed out. I'm also very, very happy and honored to be here tonight, particularly because of the other panel members whose reputation precedes them. People who are familiar with the field know that Dr. Schwartz and Rabbi Lappin are people who are well known in the field, and their reputation precedes them. I think it'll be an extremely interesting panel discussion. and very informative for myself as well as for the audience. As Rabbi Kalman mentioned, I belong to the Center for Business Ethics at the Jerusalem College of Technology, also known as Mechon Lev. This is a center that was founded about 10 years ago by Dr. Meir Tamari, who had formerly been a senior economist at the Bank of Israel. At a certain stage, decided that he wanted to devote himself to spreading the word about the importance of business ethics in Jewish life, in Jewish tradition, in Jewish law. I know that he was a guest in Toronto also about a year ago. He's written a number of books that some of you might be familiar with. So I am now continuing the work at the center as the head of research. And one of the things that I wanted to focus on when I joined the Center for Business Ethics was to try and broaden the approach a little bit. And very often, even though our center is called the Center for Business Ethics and Social Responsibility, I try not to use the term business ethics, but I try and use a broader term, which is human values in the workplace. And in other words, we're taking ethics, which is often is considered to have a very narrow approach of did I steal, didn't I steal, did I fulfill some specific ethical obligation or not, and broaden it to a much broader criterion of human values. And again, business, our people are trying to focus narrowly on business dealings, and the workplace has a much broader range of interest. And I think the topic that I chose for tonight is something that very much fits it. I think that there would be a certain overlap between what we would call in Jewish law the prohibition of lashon hara, of slander or of libel, and the traditional business ethics. At the same time, it's something that is not always perceived specifically as a business ethics kind of topic, and yet it's something we see very often. One of the very interesting projects we have at our center is a weekly online internet advice column called The Jewish Ethicist, which anyone can reach on jewishethicist.com, very simply, or on I know that HF Torah is very popular in Toronto. The project is done in conjunction with Aish and also appears on the Aish website, which is aish.com. We receive a large number of questions. I try and answer as many as I can, and one a week is answered on the site. And I discover that quite a large number of questions which we receive could really be included in the rubric of Lashon Hara. People want to know, what can I tell people? What can't I tell? What about the problem of what we call snitching, of informing on people, of letting people know what's going on? And that was really the reason that I decided to choose this topic. And another reason that I thought this was a very interesting topic is, even though I really feel that in general we have a Center for Jewish Business Ethics, I really feel that in general we're talking about Jewish business ethics or central, general business ethics. The basic ethical values and ethical concepts, I think, are generally extremely similar. And I do feel there's certain areas where there's a notable difference. And I think that the area of watching your tongue, so to speak, is one where there's a marked difference, where people, at the one hand, they do have an inherent instinct. It's bad to snitch. It's bad to inform on people. But they don't always view that as an ethical instinct. On the contrary, I think very often people feel, well, the right thing to do would be to go and inform on people and to tell people, no, that's what the ethical thing to do. That's a social responsibility. But, you know, everyone knows that they want to be in good with their friends, and so they want to avoid snitching. They want to avoid informing on people. And I really think that Jewish tradition, with its very strong aversion to informing and to telling on people, even though we will see that there is a counterbalancing aspect to it, has a much different approach and really recognizes the damage that slander and libel can result in. I'm going to give a brief introduction to the laws of Lashon Hara and then give a few examples. The Torah tells us, Al Telech Rechil Ba'amecha, I don't have the exact verse, but here it is. Lo Telech Rechil Ba'amecha, a person shouldn't go about like a talebearer. This is the usual translation. And one of the very interesting things about this particular prohibition is that it applies even to things which are true. We know that in the case of slander, libel, that truth is a defense, but in the case of Lashon Hara, of slander in Jewish law, truth is not a defense. Any speech which tends to work to someone's detriment, to denigrate him, or to insult him, to embarrass him, or to cause him loss, would be considered in the category of Lashon Hara. It still can be permitted under certain circumstances, but our first instinct is this is something which could damage somebody, it could embarrass them, it could ruin their damage their reputation. That's already Lashon Hara. We have to examine it extremely carefully. Truth, in this case, is not a defense. Reason that I would say that this is, if I'm trying to explain the difference between what I often perceive as a very great willingness, maybe it's the result of our open society, a great willingness of people to go out and say nasty things about people. It's even considered a mitzvah. You know, the newspapers talk about a right to know. I'm sure there is such a thing, but it can be taken to extremes. There's a kind of instinct that a person is doing, you know, not only getting a great, there's always, you know, revealing gossip always has its own little, special little pleasure that people have, and people can even add to the feeling they're doing a wonderful mitzvah by letting people know what a rotten person that one is or what's going on, and fulfilling people's right to know. And what is the underlying philosophical difference between the view of Judaism and that view? And I think that we could boil it down to what is our basic view of human nature. If we view people as being basically nasty people, and even though they can be encouraged to do the right thing by appropriate conditioning and so on, but at root, people have all kinds of nasty tendencies. We may even delight in that and sometimes indulge in them ourselves. Then we won't see anything wrong with going around and revealing people's shortcomings. But if we start out with a fundamental belief that people are created in God's image, that people are basically good, then even when we do see somebody doing something wrong, then how are we going to relate to that? Right? I'll just give you an example. If I see somebody who I know is a very good person, a very upright person, and a moral person, I see him doing something wrong, then I'm going to automatically say to myself, maybe I didn't see correctly what he did. I'm sure it was just a temporary lapse. You know, everybody can give themselves their own examples of people who, if they would maybe cease doing something wrong, and they would immediately excuse it and say, especially if it was a close family member, a close friend, someone who you were personally aware of their wonderful qualities, you'd say it was in a bad mood, it was a temporary lapse or something, as opposed to somebody who we know is accustomed to acting in an improper way. And if you view, if your basic view of every human being is that it's a positive one, a righteous one, then a person can adopt this attitude towards everybody and say, My first approach is I saw him doing something wrong. I heard he was doing something wrong. Maybe it's not true. Maybe there's some excuse for it. Maybe he's already regretted it. And that, I think, is the underlying point of view which leads to a prohibition that says the first thing is don't spread gossip. Afterwards, we're going to see that there are cases in which it's permissible, and that's what I'm going to discuss now. Over 100 years ago, a very, very important book, a momentous book, was written in the Jewish world. It was the book, The Chafetz Chaim, written by a very prominent Jewish scholar, Yisrael Meir HaKohen, which detailed all the different laws of Lashon Hara, of the slander prohibition. And the Chafetz Chaim basically gave five conditions which would need to be fulfilled in order that a permission for a person to speak Lashon Hara, to slander somebody else, if he believed that some benefit could come from it. There would be no other reason why I would ever want to reveal again, especially based on the approach that I outlined. If there was no benefit to be gained from revealing it, there's certainly no reason we would want to denigrate any other, our fellow human being. But even assuming there is some benefit to be gained from it, so he says, let's see the five conditions which are going to have to apply. One is that a person has examined the situation carefully. He's not instinctively just repeating something he heard or something he guessed or something he conjectured, but he's well convinced that the story he's repeating, the negative story he's repeating, is really true. It's truly convincing. The second condition is that when he repeats the story, he doesn't exaggerate. If he saw a person one time steal something, he's not going to go and say the person is a pathological kleptomaniac or something. He's going to report accurately what he knows and not to exaggerate. That's the second condition. The third condition, which we'll maybe have a chance to discuss in the context of the case study we're going to discuss afterwards, is that a person's intention should be for benefit. And it's not merely enough that he's going to achieve some benefit by revealing a person's shortcomings or a certain person's act. It has to be his intention. It can't be a vindictive intention or intention to honor himself at somebody else's expense. But his original intention has to be, in fact, to affect the benefit which he's carrying out. And the fourth very obvious condition is it has to be impossible to achieve this benefit without slandering somebody. It's very well to say, well, I can achieve some benefit by achieving slander. It must be okay. A person has to examine carefully. Maybe I can achieve the same result without slander, and then the slander becomes completely superfluous. And the final condition is that he shouldn't cause unnecessary damage to the person he's slandering. It may be the person deserves some kind of punishment, some kind of insult or whatever it is, and that's the benefit that he's allowed to speak, but it shouldn't cause excessive. A person deserves to be censured on his job. It may be improper to reveal his acts if it's going to result in him being fired from his job. If that's an undeserved, sometimes that may be deserved, but may be bad to reveal if it's going to result in him being in legal trouble when that's undeserved, and so on. We have to judge what his acts really warrant and try not to cause any unnecessary damage. And so that's the groundwork, the basic foundation of the laws of Lashon Hara. Basically, we view slander as a very serious thing. Truth is not a defense. At the same time, we all know that sometimes it may be essential to reveal someone's shortcomings, someone's acts, in order to bring about some kind of benefit. That can be proper. It may even be obligatory, as we'll see. But we have to make sure that slander is the proper way of going about it, and do it in a very restrictive and modest way, again, based on the assumption that it's always bad to cause someone harm or embarrassment. How does this, I'm sure people can immediately think to themselves of any number of examples, how this prohibition could be relevant in the workplace, which is sometimes the most active area of gossip, especially the water cooler. The water cooler still exists? Yeah. Coffee machine, whatever. Anyway, and I'm going to discuss now a few specific examples, some of which are discussed in the standard works on the topic, some of which have come my way in the many questions which people have directed to me in my column. And I think the number one area of thing that people discussed is bad-mouthing your competitors, right? This is something that everybody thinks is a mitzvah, right? A person has competitors, and not only is their product worse, but they do the ultimate sin in business. They steal my customers. And so there's always a tendency for a person to try and denigrate the merchandise or the service of a competitor. This is basically an area, I think, in which what's considered good commercial practice really is in accordance with Jewish law. I do think that in general, people who consider themselves good, honest competitors do try and avoid bad-mouthing the competitors. But I do want to open with that because it's a very common problem. It's one that's explicitly discussed in the Chafetz Chaim, who says in the fifth chapter, it's very common in our many sins that one merchant is going to say nasty things about the merchandise of his fellow merchant, and anything of this nature because of jealousy, and he says that's absolutely considered lashon hara. That's definitely considered slander. Does that mean that a person can never compare his product to that of his competitors? After all, this is a service to the customer, that he should know what a good-for-nothing my competitor is and how lousy his merchandise is. I often emphasize in my talks here in Toronto and in general that being an ethical business person and an honest business person does not mean that a person has to be a doormat. It doesn't mean that a person can't be a good competitor and an aggressive business person, but there are certain things that need to be done. A person is allowed to compare his merchandise to that of the competitor or his service, but the first thing he has to do is it shouldn't be expressed in a derogatory way, but in a accurate comparison. And so a person shouldn't say he can praise his own goods, and he can compare, in addition, things which are objectively comparable. A person can't say that guy is selling cars which are extremely dangerous, but a person can say, for instance, this car has so many miles on it and his car has fewer miles or kilometers. This car gets so many miles per gallon compared to the other person's product, microprocessor speed, things which a person can objectively verify. This is something which is not denigratory. I'm not denigrating somebody's merchandise by pointing out that it has certain characteristics, and I don't give the appearance of being a nasty and vindictive competitor if I'm sticking to things that the customer has some ability to check for himself, as opposed to making completely unfounded allegations or things that the customer has no way of finding out. This is a common question. What if I really know that the guy is a crook, my competitor, right? I can't go and point to something that he's doing that the customer could verify, but I just feel I have a responsibility to save my customer from falling into the clutches of my competitor. This is something which might truly fall in to the category of permissible speech according to the five criteria that we mentioned. It could be that I know very well that my competitor is selling used cars which are very dangerous, and I checked that for myself. I'm not exaggerating it anyway. I'm only trying to help my poor customer and not to help myself. There's no other way I'm going to save him except by warning him. And it's certainly fair and honest and proper that he shouldn't get business if he's a dishonest person. But here we run into another condition, which is the appearance of wrongdoing. This is something, a general principle in Jewish law, that a person should not only avoid doing things which are improper, he has to avoid what we call marita ayin, the appearance of wrongdoing. And everybody knows that a person who just goes and makes unverifiable allegations against his competitor, there's just no way of knowing if it's true, if it's not true, no way of checking it out. It very often will damage the reputation of the person who's making the allegation. The very simple reason that no one can check this out, who knows what's going on. And this is something which I think has to be avoided, making comparisons with competitors, things that cannot be checked out. Rather, what can be done, making straightforward, honest comparisons of your product with that of your competitor, price, performance, and so on, things that the customer has some ability to compare, and things which are not inherently negative about the competitor. The fact that his microprocessor speed is 100 minus 200, that's not a fault that he has, but it's an advantage. That's something that's that can be proper. So what's another common area where a person has to be to watch his tongue at work, besides talking about his competitors? By the way, just before I get to the next thing, there's another related prohibition which the Chafetz Chaim also mentions, and that is when a person is asking about a particular place of business, asking advice, and of course then it is proper to tell somebody, if a person is asking, can I trust this garage, can I trust this place of business, it is proper to reveal to them if they want to know, to send their business there. But a person should never ask a person's competitor about him, right? I had a situation, just a very similar situation, just a few weeks ago. I was recommended to take my car to a certain garage, and everyone knows there's all kinds of garages in this world. Some of them are more honest than others, and you have to take his word for it. You know, I always feel frustrated. There's two people you have to go to. When you go to the dentist and you go to the garage, he's the person who diagnoses it, and he treats it, and he charges for it, and all you can do is take his word for it. So I think the least I can do is go and check it out a little bit. And I asked the person, I know a person who sells used cars. It's a wonderful profession. I shouldn't badmouth used car salesmen either. No, I didn't. It's a person who sells used cars, and I asked him, I figured he must have experience fixing cars a lot, and I asked him, what do you know about this garage? And he started telling me all kinds of nasty things about this person. He says, instead, take it to me. I didn't know this person not only sells used cars, he also fixes cars on the side. And I realized that I inadvertently transgressed the prohibition explicitly mentioned in the Chafetz Chaim. Don't ask one tradesman about the quality of another. He's going to have an irresistible desire to say nasty things about his competitor. And that's another principle of Jewish law. Not only are we not allowed to do transgressions, we're not allowed to induce other people to do them. And so a related transgression to the one of slandering a competitor is asking one competitor about somebody else, which is going to create an almost irresistible temptation to make the kind of comparisons that we don't believe in. And this is something which I unfortunately and inadvertently involved myself in. And I'd like to point out that I got my car from used car salesman, who was an excellent person who I always rely on, and who gave this garage a very good recommendation. So I certainly don't mean to say nasty things about any profession. Right. Okay. What's another area of where this is a common problem? A common area which requires caution. Again, not to completely avoid saying the thing is work evaluations. Right. Worker evaluations is an area which is a normal part of a business. Every so often, a worker has to be evaluated. He has a supervisor. He has his work has to be evaluated. This is an area which fundamentally meets all the criteria of the Chafetz Chaim. Namely, I have a worker. Why am I evaluating his performance every 6 months? I don't know, 3 months, depends on the workplace. And writing it down. My intention is so that the employer is able to know if this is a good worker or not a good worker. He's able to decide to keep him on or not. So there is basically a benefit involved, right? What about the requirement? What are the basic requirements? A person knows very well what's going on. We hope that a supervisor does know. He's not going to exaggerate. He's intending to have benefit to the employer. And if there's no other way besides having a performance evaluation, and he's not going to cause any negative, undeserved negative consequences, this is something which easily can be fulfilled. In other words, I'm certainly not going to attack the institution of having performance evaluations. But if we go through these same criteria, we'll see that they have their relevant pitfalls. In other words, we talk about the requirement that a person carefully convinces himself that what he's saying is true, right? Well, very often a supervisor will have a clear idea of some shortcoming that he's putting on a performance evaluation and is going to report it because he sees the person on the shop floor or wherever else, he sees his performance and he writes down, this person has the following shortcoming, the following problem. Sometimes you get into a situation where a supervisor doesn't have clear evidence that a person is doing something wrong. It could be a coincidence that he had a lot of sick days, that he's happened to be just missing on the floor the times that I came to visit and so on. What do we do in that case? The person is not clearly convinced. On the one hand, we know that the requirement for Lashon Hara says before I go and say something nasty about somebody, I have to have very strong evidence. At the same time, we can't expect a supervisor to spend all his time paying attention to every single worker and not mention he has his own responsibility to management to point out any possible sources of future problems. And what's the solution to this? The solution to this is clearly mentioned in the Chafetz Chaim. He says if you're worried that a person is going to cause damage, you don't have clear evidence, sometimes the person has to refrain. He says in some cases it may be proper, but then you have to clearly state that what you're saying is a conjecture. So the solution to this is a supervisor who notices some problem in the performance. He's not exaggerating, he's intending to help the employer, and so on, then it's proper. What about the case of a conjecture, a mere conjecture? which he still thinks is very important for the management to know. He may write it down, but he is required to indicate that this is only conjecture. I saw the following things, which created a possibility, a question mark in my mind. He's explaining the basis for it. That would be if we're going to apply the laws of Lashon Hara to the situation, we're going to say performance evaluations are fine, but in the case where we have only conjectures, the person has to record, this is only a conjecture, and another common problem, which I don't think I even need to tell people, is to give something negative evaluation for vindictive reasons or for internal politics is certainly improper and unethical. So that is another example, besides the example of talking about competitors, another example is work evaluations, and I want to talk about one specific area of performance evaluation which I want to do further research on, but what I've seen so far makes me very suspicious of it. How much time do I have? Okay. And that is peer evaluations. This is something that reading the business press, I have the impression, again, I don't have my finger on the pulse of what's happening in the business world. I do have an impression that's becoming more popular. Instead of having a supervisor evaluate the work of a worker, we have a lot of team environments now, whether we're talking about white-collar workers who are working in teams like programmers, or even on the shop floor, we have quality circles and so on. As team work seems to be increasing, the desire to have peers evaluate one another also seems to be increasing. After a lot of people working with somebody, this is something which, again, on the face of it, seems to fulfill the five conditions we discussed. At the same time, I consider it to be a minefield. Because if you have one supervisor, so first of all, we know that he got to be a supervisor by somebody putting his trust in him to evaluate the people underneath him and to supervise him. That's the first thing. Second of all, he's much less likely to have vindictive motives since he's already above the people he's supervising in the chain of command. Another reason why we would have a better, more trust in him is it's only one person, right? And we hope that that one person is a person who is going to act in a responsible way when he's making performance evaluations. When you have many people who are, and that is another reason that a person, we say, hey, he understands, when he goes to work, he knows that he is giving an implicit waiver, an implicit permission for his supervisor to give these evaluations, even it is sometimes based on conjecture and other things. And when it comes to a person peers, all these things become much bigger question marks in the sense that, first of all, a person doesn't have the same sense of responsibility to management to give an honest evaluation if he's only a co-worker. Then you have the fact that when people are fighting together in the same workplace, the potential for vindictiveness, it seems to me, is far greater. And then the very fact that you have that many more people, you have six or seven people giving an evaluation, then all you need is one of them to be rotten, and all of a sudden you're inducing people to say Lashon Hara. And then, of course, you have another possibility that these performance evaluations are completely useless because people are only giving a quid pro quo, and then the whole original permission to have these performance evaluations is if we have a principle in data processing, garbage in, garbage out, if the data are useless, then what are you collecting for? I consider this is something which is being used. I'm not saying it can't be used properly, but if we're going to apply the criteria that we learned and then we're going to add a little dash of common sense, I think we could see this as a minefield, and whether a person is being asked to fill one of these out on his fellow workers or to impose it in the workplace, I think it needs careful thought. I can't categorically say it's wrong. It may have its value, but it's something which I think should have careful thought. And I have a course in Jewish business ethics which I teach at the Jerusalem College of Technology, and I gave an exam question, essay question, something that instructors commonly do. They want to learn something about a subject, they give it as an exam question and see what the students came up with. And one of the students came up with a very interesting additional problem, which I never thought of for these things. What I did was at the beginning of the exam period, I gave people the students evaluate their instructors. They have a little form to evaluate their instructors, and normally it's not supposed to be handed out in exam time. There was some reason it had to be done that way. I handed it out, and then immediately opened their exam, discovered that one of their exam questions is, what are the ethical implications of filling out one of these evaluation forms? While it was fresh in their memory, and I was proud that one student, as soon as I handed the form, he says, wait a minute, this could be Lashon Hara. But one of the students wrote, from his own experience, that there's a completely unrelated problem with these evaluations. He says, these evaluations create an expectation in the student that the institution is actually, that we are actually having a say in what's going on. And that the institution is actually going to look at our evaluations, and on the basis of that, it's going to have an influence on promotions, or at least you're going to talk to a person who has, and he says, I know, and I'm saying that he's right. He says, in my experience, the college doesn't even look at these, and if that's true, what's the problem? What's happening if they're not really taking advantage of the information they gather? First of all, the original benefit of this is supposed to be, the whole permission for gathering this information is that there's a benefit getting from it. And if they're not going to use the information in hiring and in promotion and so on, then that's completely lacking. And the second thing is that at the very least, it's a waste of time, right, if you're not going to use it. And then we have another problem in Jewish law, which we call onat dvarim. You're not allowed to cause someone to raise their hopes, to give them falsely raise their hopes. Here's a person that's filling out saying, well, it's a pain in the neck, but at least I'm contributing my bit to improving the level of instruction at my college. If it's not going to happen, then we have something called gneva dat. You're misleading somebody. You're getting his hopes up in a false way. And if management is going to use these peer evaluations, then we have the pitfalls that I discussed, which have to be weighed. And if they're not going to use them, then it's certainly improper, because it's at the best a waste of time, and at the worst a way of getting people to express their worst the worst qualities. What's another area where Lashon Hara is a problem in the workplace? A very interesting one is writing letters of evaluation, right? A person formerly worked at my place of work, and he wants to apply for work at a new place. The person says, what kind of worker is this? Again, on the face of it, this is a case that, in general, will meet all our criteria for the permitted Lashon Hara. What am I going to do? I'm intending only to achieve some benefit, to let this employer know what kind of worker this is, so we can decide if it's a benefit or not to hire them. That's an obvious benefit. I'm going to write only things which I'm sure of. I'm not going to exaggerate any shortcomings. Of course, these letters have their own special shorthand that a person has to know how to understand. I was talking to a friend of mine lately, and he says, whenever I get a letter of recommendation that the person is hardworking, he says, I know he's a blockhead, right? Because if the person was intelligent, I'd write that he was intelligent, I'd write that he's insightful. If he's right that he's hardworking, so he's not that it's a lie. The person has to know how to kind of read between the lines. But in any ways, assuming that a person's conforming to the shorthand that these letters are written in, and the special language, he's not going to exaggerate. His intention is only to help the new employer and so on. There's no other way to help the employer besides by writing these letters. and so on. On the face of it, this is permissible, assuming a person is writing the honest thing. There is one pitfall that these things can present, and that is that the evaluation will reach the hands of somebody who is not going to benefit from it. And that can happen one of two ways. One way it can happen is that the person who is presenting himself as a prospective employer is not really a prospective employer. This is just one of the many people have all kinds of reasons for gathering information. Some of them are credit agencies, some of them are prospective shiduchim, some of them are people who have are busybodies. And one of the ways that people may adopt to try and get information is to pose the prospective employer. A person should make sure that he has some verification that the person really is a prospective employer. And there's an additional pitfall, which is that once the information is out, you don't know where it's going to go. Even if this person really does have a valid need for the information, it may reach somebody who does not have a valid read for the information. And this is something a person always has to be on guard for. And I've mentioned this also with relation to shiduchim. A person comes, he's saying, look, I'm thinking of dating such and such a person, or my child might want to date them, and they ask information, and I've checked all these five conditions, right? And I've decided it is not only appropriate, but it is obligatory for me to reveal certain qualities of this person. And what a person hasn't remembered is that at the same time he's revealing this information to the prospective date or the prospective in-law, he has to be careful that it's not something that's going to then be revealed to the entire city of Toronto. And this is something that I don't think anybody needs to be told that can occur. And a person should be, in my opinion, as circumspect as possible in revealing information in such a way that it's not going to be useful the next step on. In other words, we do want to help people to get good information from prospective employees or prospective shiduchim, and yet, even if all the conditions are fulfilled, a person has to think about the sixth condition, is what happens to the information after I let it out, I let the cat out of the bag, and a lot of slander begins this way. It begins in a proper way, and it gets beyond, and a person has to be extra careful about what he says and how he says it to be sure that it's something that that has a short half-life, so to speak. And I'm sure that people know that this thing of letters of recommendation now in the business world itself is not so relevant because for legal reasons people are no longer writing letters of recommendation, but because they are legal minded. If you write a very good recommendation, then the employer will sue you. If you write a bad one, then the worker will sue you. And so people have been limited, but I still think it's important. Maybe that fad will pass and people find the legal solution, and so people know the Jewish approach. Yes. One more? Okay, fine. I'm going to go ahead. There's no end to the different kind of pitfalls that Lashon Hara presents in the workplace. And I am going to mention one more, where again we're going to get an insight by applying our criteria to a situation which seemingly fits it and discover that there may be a pitfall that we need to take into account, and that is informing, or what we sometimes call snitching. What if I know for sure that somebody is acting in a way that's detrimental to the workplace or to a school? I know that someone is stealing from the warehouse. I know that someone is damaging school property and so on. I want to inform the supervisor. I want to inform the school administration. This is a common problem. I think you would say it's an extremely common problem. I think that most of the time that people are doing these things, their coworkers are aware, and or their fellow students, somebody is aware. And again, on the face of it, we are fulfilling the conditions. The person sees it happening. He's not going to exaggerate. His only intention is to keep the employer from suffering harm. And this seems to be the best way of doing it. And if the person gets fired because he's shoplifting, because he's stealing, that's not an undeserved harm. That's a deserved harm. He deserves to get fired in many cases. I still think that this needs, in many cases, further thought. And the reason is the fourth condition. There's no other way of achieving the benefit. And I think that sometimes people can be creative. In other words, a person sees that he's a benefit to be achieved by saying slander, by slandering somebody, they immediately run out and say it. I think it's worth thinking carefully. I really think in the cases that have reached me, I often get the impression that people have not really devoted even a few minutes of thought to asking themselves, is this trip really necessary, or is this slip of the tongue really necessary? And asking themselves, for instance, maybe kind of just approach the person directly and say, you know what, you're doing is improper. You threaten to inform on them. That can sometimes be dangerous. I'm not saying this is always the best thing, but a person can at least ask the question, can I get the message to him that people know what's going on, that he's in danger, in a direct way, in an anonymous way, or vice versa? Can I go to management instead of saying, I know that so-and-so is stealing, can I say, I think you should be careful, I think that someone is stealing? And that way, you're not informing a specific person. If he decides to mend his ways, no one's ever going to catch him, and nothing is ever going to happen. And these are just a few examples. I can go on at length, but I think that very often, if we're talking about the five different conditions that people, when they don't want to fulfill them, they can easily fall on all of them, right? They have vindictive motives, they exaggerate, they base themselves on conjecture and so on. But among people who are anxious and sincere in wanting to apply them, I think the most common place that people fail is in condition four. They say, there's no other way for me to rectify the situation except by informing on somebody, by slandering them. I think a little bit, even devoting a few minutes to try and think creatively about other ways, I think very often would be very fruitful. And if I have just a couple of minutes for if anyone has any questions, then I can relate to them, and then we'll go to the next presentation. Yes.
At the microphone, we are going to limit our questions now. We'll have ample time later. I really want to, after in the case study part, we'll have all kinds of questions on what that.
Yeah, I'll take
have.
One or two questions, then we'll go on.
One or two questions, please.
Rabbi, there seems to be a trend now in workplace evaluations to have an element of self-evaluation. Whereby you are required, and if you don't, I guess you'll be fired for insubordination, to list a certain number of ways in a certain number of your own shortcomings, and then of course you're in a position where if you are criticized for these shortcomings, you can't say, well, you know, this isn't true, the way you can, for example, if it's only your supervisor who says that you have these shortcomings. It's the sort of situation that people find themselves in concentration camps in totalitarian countries, I think. And I know under the Chofetz Chaim's rules, you're not allowed to slander anyone, even if you yourself are implicated. But this is a matter of self-slander where no one else is implicated. What do you think of this?
Let Warren ask his question, then you'll answer it. Let Warren
ask,
and then he'll take them both together, and then we'll have a break.
Two questions. It seems to me that the Chafetz Chaim's fifth criteria can never be met, because you never know the detrimental effect that the words are going to have. How can you be the judge of what's going to happen when you say these bad words? Second thing I was wondering was, and so my question is, what's your response to that? Second thing I was wondering is, if you have a situation where you, with a colleague or someone, is there an exemption for going to discuss this with your Rav? If you have some bad problem with a business associate and you want, you're in a mess with them and you want to discuss it with your Rav, can you say whatever you want in order to get the Rav to rule on this?
Okay, so I'll answer briefly. What's your name? Don's question, I think, is a very good one. I think it is a big problem. What I have to give it more thought, but I think a lot of these tricks, it's like, that's what I'd call it. We call it a kunz, asking someone to evaluate himself. Look, I think some of these things are appropriate if you're talking about the highest levels of management, where a person is starting out. You know, if you're talking about a big company that is a high level of management, where everybody is at a high level of management, is already somebody who is an insider and has a high degree of identification with the firm, and we know that he belongs to the team, and we say we're going to try and hone our team, and we're going to try and use all of these kunzin, all these tricks. So then a person is doing it out of a feeling of, not out of imposition, but a feeling of we're doing a team effort to try and improve ourselves. I'm not thrilled about that at all, but still I can see it. If you're talking with that kind of submission, if you're talking about people who are at a low level, I have to give it further thought. But I really think that a lot of these things were never designed to be used at a person who is just a worker. You know, a worker is hired. I talked about this with many authorities also. You know, our basic idea is a worker is hired to do his job. And it's just not fair to ask a worker, you know, imagine a dock worker, he's being asked to give his shortcomings, you know. It's just not fair. You don't like his work, so fire him. You like it, keep him on. You're not trying to evaluate his humanity. You're trying to see if he's doing a good job. And I really have feeling this is something, if it's at all appropriate, it's appropriate for people who have already proven through their career that they have a high degree of identification and so on. And just to be brief, in terms of Warren's question, I already mentioned that it can be a very problem to see where your information will reach. At the same time, a person can be careful to state his things in the way that, so to speak, it has a short half-life. If some things you hear secondhand already, if it's secondhand you hear that person is a hard worker, it no longer means he's a blockhead. Right? If the first hand you do it, but at second hand it already loses that connotation. You know, things get taken out of context. And I think that there are things that can be, you know, a person can, in terms of talking to a rabbi, there's not a blanket heter to talk to a rabbi about someone. You know, a rabbi is a person who has great advantages. He has usually his personal faults. There's not a blanket permission to do that, but in many cases, again, these five conditions will be fulfilled. If I need to know how to relate to somebody, and I know that I'm not exaggerating, I know that I've looked at it carefully, my intention is to achieve a benefit, where my benefit is I'm going to know how to relate to this act, right? The same thing would apply to talk to a therapist. On the one hand, we know that laws of slander apply even when talking to a therapist. At the same time, we know that in many cases, all the five conditions will be fulfilled. And, you know, I think it's a very useful framework to try and think of these things. And I think I'm going to allow the next speaker to go ahead.
Okay, thank you very much. I think it can generate a lot of discussion. We will have time afterwards. I promise, believe me there, that we will give ample time for questions. We'll take a 4-minute break. I say 4 minutes because I mean it. And then we'll move on. So everybody can have a l'chaim.